Hi, I'm Claire Mitchell QC. Welcome to the Witches of Scotland podcast. I'm a lawyer who specialises in miscarriage of justice cases, and we're bringing you this podcast because we want to tell you about the women who were accused, prosecuted, convicted, and ultimately executed as witches in Scotland.
I'm Zoe Venditozzi, and I'm a writer who's always had an interest in the witches, and I feel that this dark mark against Scotland needs a reckoning.
The campaign Witches of Scotland wants three things. Firstly, a pardon for all those convicted of witchcraft. Secondly, an apology for all those who were accused as witches. And finally, a national monument in recognition of all those who are affected by this terrible miscarriage of justice.
Over the forthcoming weeks, we'll be talking to a whole host of experts about the history and the modern day connections to the Witches of Scotland. Hello and welcome to the Witches of Scotland podcast. We are still amazed by this, still going, endlessly going on for the rest of our lives. And this is episode 37 that we're doing today. So Claire's brother, David, our sound engineer, will be delighted that we're 31 episodes past what we told him it would be in the very early days. Today, we've got a really fascinating guest, and it's somebody that we talk to a lot on Twitter. But before we introduce her, Claire, has there been any news this week in the issue of witches and history?
Well, I'm glad you narrowed it down, because otherwise that could have been a pretty long podcast. Claire speaks the news. Yeah, so there has, in fact, funny you should ask, been some news. And we were absolutely delighted to see that the Humanist Society Scotland, of which I am a member, although I wasn't actually involved in this response or asking them to do it or anything, but they have responded to the petition that we put into Parliament as a group. And they have said that they are in support of the petition, and they've actually written a submission to the Scottish Government, and so that the Scottish Government can read what they think about it, and that's publicly available. I think we have it to hand, Zoe.
Yes, I will read this. So this is the Humanist Society Scotland submission of 5th of July 2021. So they say that they support the petition in recognising, pardoning and having a memorial to those convicted under historic witchcraft laws. As the petitions committee has already heard in evidence submitted by the petitioners, thousands of people in Scotland face persecution, torture and execution under such statutes. Such persecution was overwhelmingly directed at women, and much of the evidence and expertise on witchcraft was based on falsehoods, personal obsessions and irrational beliefs which fueled a moral panic. Witchcraft accusations and persecution were also meted out on individuals who did not conform with religious or societal expectations as a way to punish their misdemeanours. We support the petition and Parliament learning from other jurisdictions, notably Massachusetts, USA, on ways in which historical abuses handed out by the state on accusations of witchcraft may be sensibly accounted for and in some way rectified. Humanist Society Scotland too is aware of and calls for better understanding of current witchcraft-based violence in other states. For the past 6 years, Humanist Society Scotland has held a twinning partnership with Humanists Malawi as part of the Scotland-Malawi Partnership. A significant part of Humanists Malawi work in recent years has been on education of the public at large and on campaigning on behalf of those accused of witchcraft and the impacts of such persecution. The campaign group Advocacy for Alleged Witches, AFAW, so that you'll remember is Leo Igwe, who we interviewed some time ago, have highlighted how the approach of some Western NGOs to have, quote, respect for African religious and cultural beliefs, end quote, fail to condemn or properly tackle witchcraft-based violence because they refuse to determine such beliefs as superstitions. The AFAW states that attempts to tackle the issue by Western NGOs are at best wishy-washy programmes that paper over the problem of witchcraft allegations. We would encourage the Scottish Government and the committee, when considering this petition on historical witchcraft, to also consider how the government's current work in international development, particularly through the Scotland-Malawi partnership, can better challenge witchcraft-based violence. So that's really gratifying that they made such a full statement there that is obviously exactly what we are saying as well, with the looking to current and contemporary issues with accusations of witchcraft.
Yeah, I spoke to Leo about it, or should I say I spoke to him through the media of text, and he was delighted to see that the work has been highlighted, because again, his work being highlighted helps him in terms of being taken seriously by other people, saying that the work he's doing is very important, assists him in his job. So I'm really, really glad that we're once again able to highlight the great work that he's doing and trying to assist people. And also it's great that Humanist Society Scotland are working with groups in Malawi as well, trying to deal with these witchcraft matters. So I think that's fantastic that they're able to flag that up. What was quite interesting there was touched upon issues of proofs, about evidence-based matters and proofs in relation to finding people guilty of witchcraft trials, because I have two women that I would like to name as women, not witches, who are in fact women who were put to trial but were successfully acquitted because there wasn't evidence, inverted commas. Of course, there never really was evidence, but in this case, it was accepted that there was no evidence against these women. And the two women are from Dunoon. The trial took place on the 10th of September, 1680. Their names, and that's all we know about them, no other details, their names were Anne MacArthur and Isabel McClartish. And they were accused of having caused the death of a woman by using witchcraft and accused of having the devil's mark. And it's recorded that they were investigated for having the devil's mark, but it was found that they had no marks on them and that there was no evidence that they were involved in the death of the woman. So they were acquitted of that charge. Interestingly, what I also found, and this is looking at the records which are tagged in the Survey of Scottish Witchcraft, the interactive map, was that not only were the charges dropped against the two women that were accused of witchcraft, but the accuser in this case, who isn't named, went on to be sentenced to a period of public penance. Mm. So the person, and that's the first time I've ever found that, the person that's been accused. So today we remember Anne MacArthur and Isabel McClartish, not as witches or people that were accused of witchcraft, but as the women that they were, not bearing any form of devil's mark and not having caused the death of another woman.
I mean, come on. Yeah, I know. But it's interesting. It's almost as if that's planned, because our guest today, we will be talking about the four proofs of being a witch. It just all comes together so nicely sometimes, this, doesn't it?
Almost as if it's planned.
It's almost magical. So our guest for today is somebody who is really brilliantly active on Twitter and has got loads of really great stuff that she shares about her research and about her writing. So it's Mary W. Craig, who's a historian and writer. She's very interested in European culture and history, and she's written several books, including A Tangled Web, Mata Hari, Borders Witch Hunt, and Beside the Annex. And her books are really fascinating. She describes herself as being a historian whose interest is in how the politics of the elite impacts on the lives of ordinary women and men, which I think is very much concordant with what we are talking about week in, week out with our podcast. So without any further ado, please welcome Mary W. Craig. Absolutely delighted to introduce to you our guest today, who we've talked to a lot on Twitter, but this is the first time we've spoken to in real life. So I think it's going to be a fantastic session today with a very clever, agile mind, a fantastic researcher. So I think I would just like to introduce to our show today, Mary Craig. Hello, Mary.
Hello there.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you all?
Very good, thank you. Now, Mary, you are what's described as an independent scholar, a writer. You've got a great presence on Twitter because you're involved in lots of different chats. And I think the first thing I'd like to ask you today is, what is it that brought you to this sort of interest area of the witch trials and witches and witch hunts? If you wouldn't mind starting there, please.
Well, it's all my big sister's fault, which is good, because that's you always have to have a big sister to blame. When I was little, my sister and I used to go guising. We're from Glasgow. We used to go guising and I used to dress up as a witch. And when I was little, I used to watch Bewitched on the telly, remember? And she used to twitch her nose and she had a pointy hat there. So I dressed up as a witch and off I went guising. And of course, my big sister is quite a bit older than me. So when I was still sort of 7 or 8, she was already a teenager. And in that dismissive teenager way said, I'll bet that's not what a real witch looked like. And I thought, I'll show you, sort of type thing. But it actually did make me wonder, did witches really have pointy hats? Did they all have black cats and broomsticks? And that was sort of planted at the back of my mind, if you like, until I got to university and started studying and discovered that, no, they didn't have pointy hats. They may have had cats that may or may not have been black. And they did not ride on broomsticks. Scottish witches were not stupid. They didn't ride on broomsticks. Occasionally they went to sea in the south, but that's a different story. And so that's what got me interested in the fact that this stereotype of the witch with the wart, the black cat, was absolutely a load of bunkum. And I started thinking, well, what were they like? And at first I was really disappointed because they were ordinary. And I sort of thought, oh, rubbish, they're ordinary. And then actually I thought, but wait a minute, if they were ordinary folk, just like my mum or my granny, how did they end up getting executed? Well, why were ordinary people getting dragged away and executed? And that's where it started. And ever since then, I've just been fascinated by the fact that ordinary folk could get sort of caught up in this whirlwind and end up being executed by the authorities over nothing, over what was in basic nonsense, absolutely nothing. So that's where the initial spark came from. So yes, Margaret, my sister, is to blame for the whole thing.
Well, now, Claire and I are both big sisters. Maybe there'll be an origin story podcast in years to come from our little siblings saying, this is why I do such and such. I think that's fascinating, Mary, because it's something that Claire and I keep coming back to again and again and again, this idea that they're just ordinary people caught up in a ridiculous, awful, violent and brutal time.
Yeah. And I think there's also the fact that, with the greatest respect to those who are witches and Wiccan and pagan followers today, they were not these lovely, wise healers, and they all had red flowing hair and they were gathering herbs on the hillside. Some were, but most weren't. If you go through the records, most were living in tenements in Edinburgh or Glasgow or Dundee, or maybe they were on a farm somewhere, but they weren't these mystical, mythical creatures that floated about. They were ordinary Scottish women trying to get through their day in the 17th century, which was chaos, which had war and famine and plague, and we chopped the king's head off at one point. And then the church got itself in completely obsessed with the devil, and they're trying to sort of negotiate this as best they could. So that's where it actually becomes fascinating. There's a French historian known as Marc Bloch, and he once said, when you can smell the human, when you can identify the human in a story, you've got to the real heart of the history. When you read the trial records and it's something silly like an argument over a funny look and then somebody's chicken stopped laying, but then you realise if your chicken stopped laying, you've got nothing to sell at market. And if you've got nothing to sell at market, you can't buy food and your family could starve to death over the winter. What starts off as mundane can become murderous. And that's where the fascination lies.
That is some line. What starts off as mundane could be murderous. That's an incredible way to think about it, and absolutely true. So what started you then from finding out about it in the way that you did and being able to tell your sister, Margaret, I now know about these women? What then took it further? Because you've written books on the topic, haven't you?
Well, I've written one book, which is about the witch hunts and the borders, and I'm currently writing a book about the life of one particular witch in Edinburgh, Agnes Finney. But I've written previous articles. And the reason I started writing was the great and the good in the universities do all the academic research. It's absolutely fantastic because they're at the coalface, which is great. And I just pick up what they've done. Great fun. But they are very much looking at the broad picture. They're looking at all of the detail and then building that into the broad picture of what happened within that century and why we had the panics and why, you know, why the panics rose and fell and rose and fell over the century and what was happening. With me, I want to tell the story of the actual women and men that got caught up in this. And I don't want to write an academic textbook for other academics to read because that's their bag. I want to write the sort of book that anybody could pick up in a bookshop and go, oh, wow, that could be me. That could be my mother. That could be my grandmother. That could be my grandfather. And to read and understand that in the 17th century, although people were very, very like us in some ways, the circumstances caused this microcosm of chaos that led to all of these deaths. So that's why I started to write, because I didn't think that there was enough out there that was about the ordinary person and the ordinariness of it all. The fact that it was ordinary, the fact that it was mundane, the fact that it was your next door neighbour. It wasn't some spirit out on the hills that you'd never seen before. It was the women that lived next door to you. That's what's interesting to me, and that's the stories that need to be told. The names need to be remembered, the stories need to be told, the individuals need to be remembered.
We absolutely agree. I feel so strongly, and I know Zoe does too, about that specific fact that we're remembering the names of individual people and what stories happened to them, because that's the only way that you can connect with the whole. When we say 4,000 people were accused, that's perhaps undervaluing the number of people. 2,500 were executed. Again, that number is probably higher. And we trip off these phrases, but we don't actually think, hang on, that's individually 2,500 people. You know, that it's just so glib. And one of the ways I came to the witch's story taking such prominence in my mind was just a wee line in a book about the Lord Advocate George Mackenzie, known as the Bloody Mackenzie. And he went to see some witchcraft trials. And during the witchcraft trials that he was involved in watching, he came across a woman. And I'm reading this in a book at the Faculty of Advocates. It's completely empty up there. I'm by myself reading this book, which records George Mackenzie's thoughts on these matters. And he records seeing an old woman saying, "Can you be a witch and not know it?" when she was being tortured. And I welled up with tears at that. I didn't well up with tears with the figure, 2,500 women were killed, because you can't attach anything to that. But some woman being tortured, being sleep deprived, terrified out of her mind, was so discombobulated, so distressed at her circumstances, so possibly in awe or in fear of those who were investigating her, was saying, "Is it possible I'm a witch and maybe not know it? Is that maybe how this could happen?" And that's how it affected me. And really recently I've heard a great phrase called micro histories, where you look at not the story of the Tudors or the Medicis or the Kirk, but you actually look at the micro histories of people there. And that's exactly what you're describing that you're doing in your book, Mary.
I think that's why programmes like, you know, that BBC programme, is it called A House Through Time? You know, where they take, there's been like three series. I love that programme. Yeah. And it's for absolutely that reason. It's that you go, oh, so this was what life was like then, actually, just for a normal family. Or through one of those programmes, it actually made me reevaluate. And this is ridiculous, but reevaluate the idea that in the olden days, people had massive families because they expected several of them to die. And I never really thought about that particularly. I just thought, well, yeah, that makes sense. But I didn't think about the fact that, yes, of course, all those children that they had, if you had 12 and 9 of them died, that they, you know, they were all loved and longed for children that were real people. And I just thought of them as figures to keep a family going into the next generation. So I think when we look at those real stories, it's then we make the connection between the figures and who the people are. I totally agree with you, Claire. That's so fascinating to me, Mary, that you're focusing right in on one woman and telling her story. Is it hard to find enough information about one woman?
Well, with Agnes, I've been incredibly lucky because the National Library of Scotland has her entire trial records, which they very kindly digitised for me. And because she lived when she did, and it was the start of the Bishops' War and the start of the War of the Three Kingdoms, we have all of the background context. And that's important, because if you don't have the background context, it's very, very difficult to understand why the Kirk of Scotland was screaming, "Oh, old Nick's everywhere, oh, sin, ah, help, we're all going to hellfire and damnation." So they're screaming like a bunch of loons in the corner, and you've got ordinary people going, "I wonder if Jessie next door's a witch." So if you don't have the background context, it just sounds like a lot of mad people yelling at each other. Whereas if you understand the fact that you had war and famine and plague and death, well, that's the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And you've got the Reformation's not that bedded in. You've got Catholics in the continent. And then Charles I marries a Catholic, and the church gets very upset about that. The church gets very twitchy about the fact that he's married a Catholic. And so they sort of get into this seed mentality, this mindset where it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. The more pious I am as a Church of Scotland person, the more likely Auld Nick is to attack me. So therefore, the more attacks I find, the more it proves my piousness, then proves how good I am. So it becomes a sort of circle whereby everything is the devil. Everything that's happening, if the sun's too hot, that's the devil. If it's raining, it's the devil. If you stub your toe, it's the devil. And within that mindset, then what starts off as mundane, as in Jesse next door gives me a funny look and my chicken stopped laying, well, that must be the devil. Coincidence goes out the window, and you end up with a mindset where no other explanation is possible. Everybody at that time was Christian. This is one of the myths. Witches were not pagans. They did not dance about in the moonlight, you know, worshipping a pagan god. They were Christians, but they also believed in magic, as did an awful lot of people. It wasn't just ordinary folk. An awful lot of people believed in magic. So if you believe in Christianity, then there is also the devil. There is no other mindset. There's nowhere else for you to go unless there were a few Jews in Scotland at that time, but that's it. You aren't allowed any other belief system. So therefore, within that belief system, if something bad is happening, it has to come from the devil. And so you might be thinking that all you're doing is saying a little rhyme and putting out some cheese for the fairies who might help you find your lost purse, that you might actually be a witch without knowing you're a witch. So yes, so when your lady says, can I be a witch without knowing it? Well, yes, you could be. And if you then end up where the minister, who is the authority in the land, because remember, after Queen Elizabeth I dies, James VI of Scotland, or James I of England, got his fat backside on a horse as soon as he could and went down to London to where all the money was. The only authority in the land is the Kirk. So if the Kirk minister is yelling at you, you're a disgrace, you're a witch, you're going to hellfire and damnation, you believe it, because there is no alternative. Well, why would you question the minister? And so that mindset just boils and boils and boils, and it's got nowhere to go. So that when the King and the English Parliament and the Covenanters all start fighting and add to the pressure, you need a release for that pressure, and the Kirk looks round and thinks, ah, oh, women, that'll do. And so they reach back to books like Demonology, written by James VI, or the Malleus Maleficarum, written by Cramer, even though he was a Catholic, and they say, there you go, it's women. They are weak. The devil will take them. The devil will turn them into his handmaidens. And what previously was an argument between you and your neighbour over chickens then becomes the work of the devil. And you get embroiled in all this, and that's where the initial proofs, there are four proofs in witchcraft, and the first one, and the one that trips most women up, is being argumentative, having a bad reputation. If I go to Tesco's or Asda or the Co-op, and I don't like the loaf of bread I bought, I can take it back and they'll say, oh, fair enough, whatever. If I buy my bread in the marketplace and I argue about my bread, I'm a quarrelsome dame. If I don't go to church on Sunday, minister may or may not come round to my house and ask me what was wrong. If I don't go to the Kirk on Sunday, I must have been up to something. And so you get tripped up by that first proof, because it's everyday life, and life is lived in the open. You go to the market and everybody can see you. You're having an argument with your husband in the street. Everyone can see it, and that's the first of the four proofs that trips you up. And it's interesting within witchcraft in that there were men arrested and charged with witchcraft. And this is different from them being warlocks. Warlocks is different because warlocks is a position of power. There were male witches. There were very, very few male witches in Scotland, about maybe 15% possibly of those that went to trial were male. More accusations than that, there were probably about 25% accused. But interestingly, when you get to that first one, if you accuse me of being a witch, if you, after the podcast, you go away and you say, oh, that Mary's a right witch. Come on, Rose, she's from Glasgow, you know, bit iffy through there. She's a witch. And you've got the minister going, oh, well, maybe, yeah, okay, I'll investigate. If you were to accuse a man would turn around and say, how dare you? How dare you accuse me, a woman accusing me, who do you think you are? I'm a man of good standing in this community. And that accusation falls at the first hurdle. And actually, some of the women that made the initial accusation would then be arrested and tried for slander because they had slandered a man.
Now, Mary, can I ask you, you say the first proof. So this is so interesting to me, obviously, because this moves from an area of allegations to proof. And that's my world of proof and evidence. So can you explain mm-hmm. to listeners what you mean by the phrase, the four proofs? Before we go on.
So the four proofs, if I'm arrested and I end up in court, they'll say the first proof against her is that she is a quarrelsome dame with a bad reputation. So she doesn't go to the church, she argues with people. That's proof number one. Proof number two is that I have been delated as a witch, which means that another known witch called me a witch. So it's not just my neighbour calling me a witch, it's another person who is a witch calling me a witch. The third proof is me confessing to being a witch. And the fourth proof is me having the devil's mark on me, because I make a pact with the devil to follow him as a handmaiden, and he lays his hands on me in a sort of parody of Christ. And he would lay his hands on your head or your shoulders, but because the devil was unnatural, he would mark you, and there would be an unnatural mark on your skin, maybe a mole or a freckle. And they would bring in a witch broader or a witch pricker who would bring in a bodkin, a steel bodkin, usually a couple of inches long, which he would plunge into your skin. And obviously, if it was a devil's mark, you wouldn't feel any pain, it wouldn't bleed, and you wouldn't cry out. Now, if they thought you had the devil's mark, and then they brought a witch broader in and you couldn't find it, this didn't prove you didn't have it. This proved that you were an even trickier witch and you'd managed to hide it from him. I know this is a podcast, but I can see your little legal eyes getting very agitated at that one.
It's my whole legal body has become very agitated by that. Yeah. And by four proofs, were they the recognised legal?
They were the recognised four in Scots law, yes.
So that's so interesting that the first proof is being quarrelsome. And you say that men were less likely to be held up on that proof than women. Well, how interesting that it is that we still in society think that women, you know, men, when they're speaking their point, they're being assertive, but perhaps women are being quarrelsome. Or those phrases still exist in our society, even up till very recently. I was really, really delighted to receive a request on a legal website which said, we're looking for a review of X person as a lawyer. Can you remember to consider the way that you use your language? So, you know, don't attribute characteristics like a fearless lawyer to a man and a sensitive lawyer to a woman. I thought that was really interesting, the way that we're actually trying to ask people to consider that. So the very first thing that would cause you problems as a woman as if you were a quarrelsome dame.
Yes, and you see a lot of the records will actually have that phrase, a quarrelsome dame, will be in the trial records.
I'm totally updating my bio on Twitter.
Yeah.
Being a quarrelsome dame. There was a get out of jail free card, sort of. If you could prove that you weren't a quarrelsome dame, but you were addled in your wits, then under Scots law, you couldn't be arrested because it was accepted that you could be addled in your wits. But yet again, the church got involved in that. And as far as the Kirk was concerned, if you were addled in your wits, well, ha-ha, it was your own stupid fault for following the devil, and that was your punishment. But on the other hand, it was, nah, she's pretending to be addled in her wits, because that's her being a tricksy witch again. She's pretending that she's got a dementia or confusion or madness. And again, that splits, there's a gender split there again, because women were constantly accused of faking being addled in their wits. Male witches who were addled in their wits got sent to the asylum. There are lists of male witches in the asylum house in Edinburgh. Female witches were still executed, but they were addled in their wits. They couldn't be put to trial and couldn't be executed, so they were put away in an asylum. Whereas if they were female, we're still going to try them anyway. The doctors would examine these women and say, yep, she's at that Mary, she's addled in her wits. And the Kirk minister would come in and go, no, she's not, she's faking it. And you'd end up in trial.
That's so fascinating. So even before we get to the stage of proving someone was a witch, if men were, if their mental ability at that time was such that they weren't making sense, that could be attributed to being a witch. But if that happened to men, they were placed in asylums, or some of them
were. Most of them were. It depended, but most of them were. I mean, there's a couple of cases. There's Hobgreave in Lauder, who was still executed, even though he was completely addled in his wits, because of the treatment he had received while in prison. But he was still executed. But most men were. There's notes in Stobo. In Stobo, there were two men who visited the warlock in the asylum in Edinburgh. And not only was this warlock in the asylum in Edinburgh not been executed, the two men that visited him on a frequent basis were not arrested for consulting with a witch or a warlock, which was illegal.
Now, you made the point there that witches and warlocks weren't just female and male. A warlock was something different. Can you explain what a warlock was and why that's different?
Yes, a witch is the devil's handmaiden, and that's why the majority were women, although you could get male witches. But if you were a man of some status, the Kirk couldn't get their heads round witches having power. Witches' power had to come from the devil, had to come from Old Nick. But if you got a male witch, the Kirk got very confused by this, because this meant that men were on the same level as women, as witches. And so what they did was, for the men who had a bit of education or a bit of money or a bit of status in the community, they got promoted to warlock. And so you weren't a handmaiden anymore, you were a follower. Because witches just blindly followed them, because all women are stupid, we know that, so we all just followed them, we just did as we were told, because we're all idiots. Whereas men made a pact with the devil.
Isn't that worse?
Yes, it was worse, but it was their get out of jail free card to still allow men to have a superior status to women. I mean, one of the worst cases they had was Major Thomas Weir of Edinburgh, who was a minister and turned out to be a warlock as well. He was also sleeping with his sister, but they glossed over that part. But yes, if you were a warlock, it was worse than being a witch. But it did mean that you had power. And also, as a warlock, you controlled the witches. So that made sense, because that's the hierarchy of the world. And there had to be a hierarchy. So they sort of invented warlocks.
And were they still executed?
Most were.
Was it the same method as was used with the witches, with the female witches?
No. The death of male witches and warlocks was also slightly different. If you were a male witch, you tended to be worried, strangled, and then your dead body burned. But if you were a warlock, and depending on how much money and status you had, you could be executed with an axe. So it was a lot quicker and a lot cleaner, allegedly. But yes, you could do that. There was also high numbers of male witches who were allowed to escape. It's amazing how many of them managed to escape from prison. I'm not aware of any female witch in the records ever managing to escape from prison. Male witches were also, when you were arrested as a female witch, you went straight to the toll booth. No questions asked. As a male witch, if you were arrested, you would say, oh, well, I mean, I know I'm a witch, but I don't want to go to prison. Can I stay at home until my trial? And that was allowed. So they got away with that, which meant they could escape. Those that couldn't escape often committed suicide, because if you die as a witch, your estate is forfeit to the crown. If you die as a suicide, it's still a disgrace, but your family can inherit. So the men could do that. Even, as I say, even after sentencing, there's a higher rate for acquittal. Men had a higher acquittal rate than women. And then even if they were found guilty, they frequently seem to escape somehow. The cell door seemed to be left open or something. I'm not quite sure how that happened, but it seemed to happen quite a lot for men and not so much for women. I've never come across the record of a woman escaping prison, ever.
We came across one recently. Oh. That's the only one that I've ever found.
How do you remember all this, Claire? You've got such a sharp legal mind.
Because I'm equally cursed and blessed with some things sticking in my mind, but not why I came into any given room at any time. That totally escapes me, but yeah.
There were also cases where people were found not guilty and not released. There's a case in Peeblesshire in 1629, I think, where 24 people were brought to trial, and 24 or 25, say it was 24, and 22 of them were found guilty and executed. The other two were found, your legal mind will like this, not proven. The famous not proven. So they got a not proven, which meant they should have been released. But they weren't, because the Kirk minister went, nah, we're not letting them out. Two women, and they were chucked back in prison. After the execution of the 22, they ran the trial of the other two all over again. Exactly the same evidence, but they brought in a new bit of evidence. They were the known associates of executed witches. Therefore, they must be witches. They had the same jury and everything. And guess what? They were found guilty.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, it's just incomprehensibly.
Yeah. I mean, that was one of the other proofs. So let me get this right. The four proofs were a quarrelsome dame being a known...
Being deleted by another witch.
Being deleted. Is
being
that...
named by another witch.
Okay. So being
confessing named... to being a witch yourself or having the devil's mark. In this case, the minister decided that the evidence was they were the known associates. They were the associates of known executed witches. That was frequently used.
That kind of fits within the second one. If a witch names you or you're an associate of a witch, then that's like, you know, you fly with the cross. The difficulty is that who wasn't in Scotland an associate of a known witch, given the fact there was only a million people and everyone was calling everyone else a witch?
And also, I mean, this is why if you go through the records, you see these situations where there are mothers and daughters. Mothers and daughters was so common and it was desperate. You know, you had, and you see, this comes back to what we were talking about, individual cases where you have people denying that they know you. Quite rightly so, because they're terrified. All of a sudden it's, no, she's not my mother, she's my stepmother, or that's not my daughter, we just took her in. The case of the witch Agnes that I'm researching in Edinburgh is quite interesting, because her grown-up daughter sticks by her and goes up to visit her in prison and brings her food and puts up with the guards yelling at her and, you know, being horrible to her, and she sticks by her because most, especially male relatives, they were gone. There was no way your husband was sticking by you, or your brother or your father. In a way, you can understand why, because they were so terrified that they would be the next one yanked in. And also, again, your legal mind is going to like this one. Sleep deprivation was one of the most effective ways of getting people to confess. You know, it's like, as I always say, you know, you bring your first child home and it's lovely, a little, you know, little pink bundle. And within 3 days, you're so sleep deprived, you're putting your slippers in the microwave. You know, it just is, it's awful. And so at the end of 3 days, I mean, I would have named my big sister. Let me put that out there right now. My sister would have been named straight off if I'd ever been, you know. We shouldn't laugh about it, but it's true. If you are so terrified, the minister is telling you your very soul is going to damnation. You're under physical pressure, you're under psychological pressure, you're under emotional pressure. You're so exhausted. I'm actually amazed by the people that didn't confess.
Yes.
The ones that just went, nah. Those are the ones that I just go, wow, because I know myself. I would have been naming everybody I knew within an hour. I know it.
I absolutely agree, because people are always surprised that confessions happen, even in the modern day. Now, in the modern day, of course, there are people that get pressure put on them to confess by various different people. But even when the circumstances are quite benign, shall we say, you know, like you've got a lawyer beside you, or you've been told you're not allowed to say anything, but people still confess to things they haven't done. And the general public find that really, really difficult to cope with. They say, well, I would never do that. That would never happen to me. And yet time and time we see that people do confess to things they haven't done, even when they're not sleep deprived. So, Mary, you're absolutely right that the people who survived through that and said, I am not confessing to that, were incredible outliers in terms of their ability to withstand that kind of psychological pressure.
My witch Agnes refused, absolutely point blank refused. And not only did she refuse, she was a feisty personality. She said, I'm not a witch. Never have been, never will be. And by the way, you haven't found a single thing in my house to prove I'm a witch, because they searched her house. She said, you've been burning witches down in Leith and not one of them has named me. You've been burning witches in Edinburgh and not one of them has named me. You have searched my house and you have found not a single thing, not a poppet, nor nothing, your little doll, little poppet dolls they sometimes had. nothing. You have found nothing. You have got nothing on me. They were very angry with Agnes. She ended up in prison for a long time while they ran about trying to find the proof that she was a witch.
How did you come across Agnes as the person they wanted to research and write about?
I know that the trial of Isabel Gowdy is famous because of Isabel Gowdy's confession. And there are lots of things about witches. After I wrote my book, lots of people were contacting me about witches, and they were all talking about rural areas. And I'd previously written about the bewitching of James Maxwell in Glasgow and Pollock. And I was looking for something else because, again, I wanted to get away from the stereotype of the little old lady gathering herbs. And so I was looking for a witch that lived in a city. I'm a city girl myself. Where's this witch? She's living in a city. She's living in a tenement. She's an ordinary person. And then she gets caught up in all of this. I went to hunting for somebody whose trial records were out there to see if I could find somebody with complete trial records. And I was lucky enough. I was literally going through the alphabet and I found Agnes first. It was as simple as that. And then once I started to read, especially to the end of what happened when she was found guilty, it was what happened at the end of that that I thought, yes, that's the one I want. That's the girl for me.
Are you going to keep that a secret so we read the book, or do you want to tell us? It's up to you.
I can tell you now. It's so good. At the beginning of the trial, so as I say, Agnes, she's not poor. She's not living in the countryside. She's not actually a very pleasant person. She manages to get herself two advocates who defended her and never worked again in Edinburgh. I think they sort of blotted their copybook taking on her trial. But she starts off, I'm not a witch, I'm not a witch, I'm not a witch. Gets to the vet, and she went through prison and a trial and a long trial and a long wait. The judge took a long time to find her guilty, which was really unusual. It normally happens within half a day. They took weeks with Agnes. Finally, they decide, yep, she's guilty. Brought her back into court, said, right, that's it, you're guilty and you're going to be executed. And all of a sudden, Agnes, who had denied it all, turned around and she went, yep, I'm a witch. And you know what? I'm a rank witch, which means one who is proud and noble. And she has now been one for 28 years. And I was like, yes, she did just like stuff you lot. Okay, you found me guilty. Okay, I'll confess. But she kept her defence until the very last minute. And then she went, okay, right, fair enough. But I've been doing it for 28 years. It's taken you this long to catch me. So I was really pleased with that. As far as Agnes was concerned, she was a witch and a rank one.
And do you think that was her, in the sense that, was she a witch cavorting with the devil? Was she just saying, yes, I am, I did those things? Or was she just saying, right, I'll show you, if you say I'm a witch, I'm a witch?
No, I think she was. Having read through what she did over that 28-year period, there were occasions in the neighbourhood, because the neighbourhood called her a witch, and Agnes got to the stage where she was arguing with people and saying things like, don't you call me a witch, the way so-and-so called me a witch, because she knew being called a witch was a death sentence. But she did practice magic. She did do magic. She was a witch. She might not have been a follower of the devil, because that was the Kirk's obsession. See, this is the problem is,
yes.
Witches were not obsessed with Old Nick. Witches were Christians who also practiced magic. They believed and they understood that there were supernatural beings like fairies and kelpies and selkies that could help you in life. The Kirk was obsessed with the devil because, of course, it's another male figure, isn't it? It has to be a male figure. And they would say to witches things like, they wouldn't ask a question like, did you meet the devil? Because you can say no to that. They would say things like, when you met the devil, what was he wearing? So then you go, I didn't meet him. Well, when you met the man in the black hat, what did he say to you? And they said, well, he said, aha, so you did meet the devil. So they would push and push and push. So Agnes wasn't following the devil in the sense that Kirk thought she was, but she was practicing magic. She was a witch.
We've come across a lot of what's described as white magic in the researches. That's what they mean by, well, that was the description given to people who were practicing something which wasn't being in cahoots with the devil. It was, as you say, asking fairies for help, or almost like the charmers. People would go to them to ask for help for individual things, but they weren't calling on the power of the devil to help them. And that seems to be the differential between what the Kirk was interested in rooting out was the devil in society and what other people were doing, which was, I've spoiled some milk and now you won't be bewitched anymore by with whatever bad luck you had or stuff like that. Is that the real line of difference, which is the Kirk were obsessed with the devil in society and people who were practicing magic could practice magic with no connection to the devil whatsoever?
Yes, the only thing I'd challenge on that is the use of the phrase white magic.
Okay.
That's a very, very modern phraseology between white and black magic. It's a very a 19th century, let's pretend we're druids invention. But yes, I mean, there may well have been Satanists out there. I don't know. But yeah, the witches were practicing magic and the devil was the obsession of the Kirk. Because of course, if you think about it, the Kirk couldn't accept witches as not being under the power of the devil. Because if you take the devil out of it, right, these are women exercising power. You can't have that, can you? If I'm able to cure your child's illness, or if I'm able to help you find your lost purse or whatever it is, and I have the power to do that as a woman, where's that power coming from? It can't be coming from me. It has to come from a male authority figure. So if you take the devil out of it, then the church is left there admitting that women have power. You can't do that. Absolutely. You know, this is the mindset that they had. They could not conceive of women having power. And all the Kelpies and fairies and Selkies, if they were helpers, they were female. And if they were tricksy, they were male or whatever. But they were always under the authority of a male figure. Because if you don't have that, remember, we're not that far off John Knox and he's trumping against a monstrous regiment of women. And you had Queen Elizabeth I, and we know how that, we had Bloody Mary, oh, look what she did. We had Mary of Guise, oh, look what she did. There has to be a man in charge. And so even though you're sitting there, as you say, maybe getting some herbs together to help your neighbour's child, it doesn't matter. Even if you don't know you're a witch, even if you don't know the devil is your master, he must be your master. Because otherwise, you're a woman with power, and that's anathema. You can't have that.
Maybe, what do you think about the campaign to have the witches pardoned and an apology? You know, you don't have to say you're for it just because you're talking to us, because I know not everybody would necessarily agree with it and might think that time has passed. Do you think that there's a place for it?
Yes, I do. I always think that people work best if they have a sense of belonging and a sense of community, and that to find your place in the modern world, you need to reach back into your history to find your roots. But if you're going to do that, then you have to accept the negative in your roots as well as the positives. There is no point in us doing a Pollyanna thing about everybody in Scotland's lovely and we were all very nice. And that happened a long time ago, so it doesn't matter. Because it does matter. And we need to talk about it because it's a repeating pattern. In the 17th century, the Kirk was under stress. Everybody was under stress. There was war, there was famine, there was plague. And the Kirk said, who can we pick on today? I know, women, witches. And you say, oh, well, that was a long time ago. 20th century Germany, under stress. Who can we pick on today? Oh, let's have a go at the Jews. Modern day America, we're under stress. Who are we going to have a go at? The Muslims. It is a repeating pattern. And if we want to break that pattern, we have to break that pattern by naming every single person where possible to say, this was somebody's mother, this was somebody's father, this was somebody's sister, this was somebody's daughter. And Agnes, in a way, is important because she's not nice. She's not some sweet little old lady out in the countryside getting herbs. She was thrown, bad-tempered, a pain in the tonsils, a delight to research, but an ordinary person. And this is what happened to ordinary people. So yes, this campaign is incredibly important because we need to admit who we were, and the fact that occasionally we can turn into monsters. Well, let's not turn into monsters again, is the one lesson we can learn from it. But also, those people deserve to have their stories told. And they do deserve to say, you know what, we were wrong. And nobody stopped it. Because the stopping of the witchcraft trials didn't come from Scotland, it came from Europe. And it only came from Europe because we suddenly didn't want to be behind everybody else. So, yes, we've got a lot to answer for. It's not a case of us wondering about going, oh, aren't we terrible people? It's a case of saying, that was a really bad thing we did. We need to recognise it, we need to mark it, and those individual stories need to be told.
That's very much where our thinking is with it as well. Now, I know that our listeners today will be desperate to read about your witch. So where are you at with that, and where can they follow to find out how they can read the book when it comes out?
The book is about two-thirds written. I'm hoping it will be out possibly March of next year, which would be the anniversary of Agnes's execution. I'm on Twitter and I'm on Facebook, and I actually have a blog site, if I can remember. Yes, I've got a blog site, marywcraig.com. And I post periodically about bits and bobs, and I'm happy to ask questions and answer questions and be challenged about absolutely everything I have said today. I'm quite sure there's lots of people are going to, once they've heard your wonderful podcast, send me messages on Twitter and tell me exactly what they think about me shouting about white magic and druids. And that's absolutely fine. That's absolutely fine. Yeah, I look forward to lots more excitement from you guys and hearing the other things that you've got going on as well.
Yeah, well, what we'll do is we'll put links up so people can then follow you and interact with you. What we found, though, is that it's very, very rare for people to be negative. You know, usually people are very interested and very keen to learn and come from a position really that we're coming from, which is that you don't know a lot of this stuff. You don't know the details of it. And it's just sort of endlessly fascinating. I think the one, as you've said there, I think the one contentious point is this kind of group of modern day witches who think that the witches of Scotland were like them, but just in the olden days. But we keep having experts such as yourself who are saying that's just not true. And it's a nice story, but it just isn't true. These were ordinary people. And that's something that we just keep coming back to again and again, because I think that to romanticize them as being the red-headed, three-nippled, left-handed Herbie ladies is, you know, like you said, there will have been some women that did fit into that. But the vast, vast, vast majority were just people just going about their lives and trying to survive in a really awful, tumultuous time. And I think it's super important that we just keep remembering that. And I completely agree with what you're saying about otherwise we're doomed to just repeat it again. I mean, look at what's happening just now. This might not immediately seem like an obvious parallel, but I saw the footage last night on Twitter of poor Chris Whitty getting attacked by people. Just he's going about his life. And there's people standing outside his house, the placard saying that he's a liar and it's all just made up and he's ruining their lives and he's taking away their freedom. And that's a lot of people that are scared, I think, or ignorant, who are looking for somebody to blame for the fact that things are out with their control. And I think it is something that we as humans, unfortunately, are incredibly good at, which is picking people out and throwing all our fears and worries at them. So I think it's been fantastic to have you on today, Mary. It's been really, really interesting.
It has. Thank you so much, Mary. I've loved the four truths. I've loved the warlocks and witches being explained to us. Somebody contacted us actually on Twitter to ask about that, warlocks and witches. So hopefully they're listening and their answers will be given from you today. And please do stay in contact with us and keep up with us on, again, Twitter, Insta and stuff like that. And we'll want to let listeners know as soon as your new book comes out, and also point them to the direction of the book that you have already published at the moment.
Indeed. Yep, Borders Witch Hunt, you can get it in decent bookshops or Amazon or direct from Lewis, the publishers.
We'll put links up as well because people are keen and they love to buy the books, we have realised. Thank you so much, Mary. It's been an absolute pleasure. So, Claire, would you describe yourself as a quarrelsome dame? He said with absolutely no edge or angle to her question whatsoever.
The thing is, if I say no, you'll say, but yes, you are, and then I'll have to argue with you about it.
Oh, thereby.
Thereby confirming. And if I say yes, I've confirmed it anyway. So
you're between a rock and a hard place there, lady.
I am. So I choose yes. I'm a quarrelsome dame.
Yeah, I think that anybody that knows me wouldn't really need me to answer that question. Obviously, I'm not. I am a paragon of virtue who never quarrels with anybody ever. So, Claire, I accuse you.
It's funny how those doing the accusing are perhaps
yes,
also guilty of the offence.
No, I definitely am a quarrelsome dame. Yes. I'm mouthy for sure and chippy. I quite like it. I was talking to my gran the other week, and my gran is an old lady, unsurprisingly, who left school at like 14 to work in the mills in Dundee. And she is, I would say, very chippy. She's very feisty. My youngest child, who's 13, who thinks he's quite tough, he's not, really enjoys her because she's got this really kind of tough granny aspect. And she'll say things to you like, pick a Wendy, meaning like which one she's going to throw you out of. And she's quite funny. And she said at one point to, she was telling Rocco this bonkers story, and she said something and she went, and you know what? The McLanders in me came out and I just gave her what for. And I just went, oh, so it's the McLanders part of our family that explains everything. I wonder if I was to trace that back, if they would be full of quarrelsome dames.
I love that name, the Clan McLanders.
Clan McLanders.
I mean, you probably see them getting into fights. I mean, I'm kind of an outlander imagining the Clan McLanders. Yeah. Is there a McLanders tartan?
I don't know, actually. I don't know. I should look into it. The only thing I ever knew about the McLanders was that somebody had said to me, and this is probably just junk history, but somebody had said to me that McLanders was like Viking linked because it meant like the son of the Landers, like the Landers in Scotland. But I think that's just a story that probably made the McLanders feel pretty cool about themselves. So I thought there's probably absolutely no evidence for that whatsoever. But if anybody does know what the name McLanders, if that does have any link, I'd love to hear it. Don't tell me if it actually means that they were like no harm to this group, but like quiet stamp collecting postmistresses or something. I quite like the fact that there's like a tough idea. Yeah.
Feisty group. Well, yeah, I'm updating my Twitter bio to see I'm adding in the quarrelsome theme. Why not?
I like it. I think it's good. It sounds quite fancy as well, I think.
It sounds like James Cagney in the 50s.
Yeah.
That's
like that. We'll have to start wearing nice little sort of 40 style suits. And have a little lady's gun in her purse.
I would caution against that.
Yeah, probably would. I was just joking, Your Honour. It was all in jest. I don't have a little tiny gun in my little handbag. I don't even carry a handbag.
No.
And we've talked about this before. Women's dresses don't have the pockets required for gun handling.
Do you know that there was chat about pockets were got rid of so women couldn't hide items of witchcraft in them?
Well, it's funny you should say that. I know this podcast is all about witch stuff. They should talk about that in an organised manner.
and not when they're trying to do the ending of their show.
Yeah. So if you're interested in that, you can follow us on various social media outlets, including Twitter, Facebook. What else?
YouTube,
Instagram, and TikTok, even though there's no content on TikTok.
We're definitely going to do a content. When we're both together at the same time, we'll do a TikTok.
Yeah, okay. I'll look forward to that. We don't have to do a dance, do we?
No.
It's not like a witch's sea shanty.
No, although I'm sure if you Google it, there will be one out there, but I'm thinking more.
No. I'll just stick with my Derringer in my purse. Right, okay. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back in a fortnight. Please, as ever, do get in touch with us if you've got anything interesting to tell us about. Twitter's probably the best place because we can have a good old chat on there. And if you do know anything about the name McLanders that's cool, please do let me know.
Bye from the Witches of Scotland.
Bye.
If you'd like to learn more about the Witches of Scotland, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Sign up for our mailing list at www.witchesofscotland.com to keep updated with the campaign. On that site, you'll be able to find how to link with us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.